This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Happy 100th birthday to the Pearl Harbor Shipyard. The military had a big birthday bash to mark the event. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was on hand yesterday to celebrate this bit of naval history, and he's here now to tell us about the investment in the future of our economic driver. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Catherine. Yeah, so this is the Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard on Oahu, and specifically it was Dry Dock 1 that turned 100 this week. So that's one of the facilities in which Navy ships go to get major repairs done. They're lifted up out of the water. That's why it's called a dry dock. It was built in 1919, or they started construction earlier, and it was completed in 1919. And it was the site of several pretty historic repairs over the years. There were two destroyers that were damaged in the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, were fixed there. And just 2 months later, or 6 months later, rather, the aircraft carrier USS Yorktown was repaired. And this was really one of the great feats of World War II on the American side. The ship had been heavily damaged in the Battle of the Coral Sea 6 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor. And when it returned, a shift captain at the shipyard told the Navy's top admiral, Chester Nimitz, that it would take 3 months to fully repair the damage. And Nimitz gave them 3 days to complete the work. And they were able to do it by working round the clock for 72 hours. Everyone, all the workers from the shipyard kind of came in. It was all hands on deck. And the Yorktown was able to get repaired and get underway, and it left for Midway, where it participated in that really famous battle, which is viewed as the turning point in the war in the Pacific. And it really, this facility really remains critical to this day, according to the Navy. It's one of only four publicly owned, so owned by the government, shipyards that the U.S. Navy has. And it's the only one that's outside of the continental U.S. There's two on the East Coast, one in the Seattle area, and then the one here at Pearl Harbor. But the shipyards haven't really gotten much investment in recent years. There hasn't been a major overhaul since the 1960s and 70s when nuclear-powered vessels were introduced. But the facility really does remain critical to operations of the Navy. And I asked the facility commander, Navy Captain Gregory Burton, about that yesterday at the ceremony.
This shipyard is strategically vital in our Navy. There's only four public shipyards. This is one of the four. And when you look between the West Coast and the Far East, you know, what fully capable depot maintenance capabilities there are, you know, this is the only one. So strategically vital. It's been that way since Congress authorized the shipyard in 1908. With the construction of Dry Dock 1 that we just celebrated a centennial for today. And it continues with additional dry docks that we've constructed during World War II, Dry Docks 2, 3, and 4.
We heard some of the historical work that's been done here. Could you tell us a little bit about what's being done today?
Well, there's a recognition from Congress that across our public shipyards, there's a need for infrastructure improvement. We haven't really sustained our infrastructure since we incorporated nuclear power into our naval inventory back in the 50s and 60s. So we saw some pretty big infrastructure improvements then. And since then, we've been in a declining sustainment mode in shipyards. And Congress has recognized the need to improve facilities and infrastructure in the shipyards. Some of the things that you can't even see from, you know, eye level are the utilities and, you know, water mains, seawater, freshwater, electrical power underneath that are also in need of upgrading and repair. So we're in the process of doing what we call a shipyard infrastructure optimization plan that Congress has notionally agreed to about a $21 billion outlay over 20 years for all four of the public shipyards. I don't know how much of that funding may come to Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard. We certainly have a need for those facility upgrades, but we're putting plans in place to get those projects formed so that we can maximize our capacity and our productivity here in Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard.
I know you can't talk about everything, but what kinds of upgrades will be needed to happen here to accommodate future classes of vessels or even existing ones?
Well, when we finish up our last Los Angeles class availability in Dry Dock 3, it's a fast attack missile submarine. Dry Dock 3 will become obsolete. The Virginia class submarines, we can't provide enough lift, even with buoyancy assist modules, to bring a Los Angeles class submarine in. So we'll need a new dock to take care of the future block designs in the Virginia class submarine, as well as the new larger submarine designs that will be coming out.
And so, Catherine, that was Captain Gregory Burton, commanding officer of the Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard. And you heard him mention $21 billion approved kind of tentatively by Congress. That was back in February to make improvements to the four government-owned naval shipyards. So, and that would be over 20 years. So, as he mentioned, unclear how much of that would come here to Hawaii. That was a question I posed to one of our congressional representatives, Ed Case, who represents the 1st Congressional District, Urban Honolulu. He was at yesterday's ceremony, and I talked to him a little bit about the importance of the shipyard, both strategically and economically.
The importance of the shipyard is not going to decrease in our nation's defense. It's only going to increase. We face incredible challenges in the Indo-Pacific over the next couple of generations. We all know that now. And our country is committed to maintaining the absolute best military and defense posture we can, both for our own country and for our allies and partners, and for all of those who believe in the multi-generation peace that we've had. And so I believe that the role of the shipyard is only going to increase. We are going to have to invest and will be investing billions of dollars here over the next 20 years. The Navy has that need. They have that commitment, and we need to fund that, and I think we will. And so, obviously, together with just a sheer dollar investment in infrastructure and repairing dry docks and optimizing the shipyard, we always need to remember that it's not just facilities, it's people, it's the personnel. And we have the top talent in the world right here at our shipyard, and we need to keep it that way. And so I'm very encouraged by the quality of the shipyard personnel nowadays. They're doing the toughest jobs in the entire Navy, right here. They're repairing the most complex machines. They're taking care of the most complex workloads. They are handling the most complex project management challenges out there. And they're doing it with incredible capability. And so we need to maintain that. And so all of the apprentice programs that we run, all of the programs that we run to find the next generation of Pearl Harbor workers, train them, get them in, and train them up into positions of great responsibility and competence, we need to continue all of that.
Do you think there will be any issues securing that type of funding with a divided government?
You know, divided government comes and goes. But the needs of our national defense, for the most part, are constant over time. And so I've found, and I speak as a member of the House Appropriations Committee, and more directly, a member of the Subcommittee on Military Construction and Veterans Affairs. So that subcommittee is responsible for all military construction, including the repair and maintenance of Pearl Harbor. I have found it to be a quite nonpartisan approach. I think everybody understands the needs of our country in the Indo-Pacific. Every opportunity I have, I bring my colleagues right here to appreciate the strategic importance of Pearl Harbor and of our military. I just had a delegation out here from my MILCON subcommittee just a few months ago. We always take the opportunity to impress on our colleagues back in Washington what the importance is, but not just to talk about it, but to actually show it to them. And I have always found that if they come here and experience what I am responsible for and live every day, that they do appreciate the necessity of continuing that funding and really understanding the context for the military's appropriations request. So I'm really not worried about divided government over time. Now, that's a problem in other areas of our country, but this is one of the areas where all parties do tend to cooperate over time.
So Catherine, Hawaii Congressman Ed Case there. We'll have to see what plays out with the funding, but you heard him there sounding pretty confident that it will come through.
Yeah, and he did talk about the workforce, and I believe the shipyard just had one of their largest graduating classes, so that's terrific.
Yeah, just last week, I believe. They hire for the apprentice program every year. I think they're having a job fair in September at the Blaisdell, they said, so people can be on the lookout for that, and they usually take 100 to 200 new apprentices each year.
Yeah, so good for them. A workforce, very important part of the island's economy. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Sure thing.
That was HPR's Ryan Finnerty talking about a centennial celebration at our Pearl Harbor shipyard.
One ocean, one people, one canoe. HPR invites the Kauai community to a screening of Moana Nui A Kea, the documentary of Hokulea's landmark worldwide voyage, and a Q&A with Hokulea crew members. Saturday, August 31st at Kauai Community College's Performing Arts Center. Reserve your spot at hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Dawson.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Up next, your backyard quiz. This morning, we're visiting the Valley Isles Kula District, exploring the region that stretches across the western slopes of Haleakala. For farmers, the climate and the rich red soil are ideal for growing crops such as lettuce, potatoes, and our world-famous Maui onions. And for you lavender lovers, there's plenty of that too. Farming in Kula began nearly two centuries ago in the early 1800s with the arrival of Western and Chinese settlers. Now, their crops were largely taro and rice, and in later years, sugarcane. As trade began to pick up, farmers started cultivating potatoes, a crop that didn't grow well on other islands. Now, whaling ships stocked up on provisions when they made port in Lahaina. And in the record-setting year of 1846, a total of 736 whaling ships docked in Hawaii, and a reported 20,000 barrels of potatoes were actually hauled down the slopes of Haleakala to fill them. After whaling petered out once petroleum replaced whale oil, the gold rush in California kept demand for Kula vegetables high. For this morning's quiz, can you tell us the nickname that Kula acquired when its produce supplied these gold miners? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Stanley Ewan from Kaka'ako, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Scam alert. The Office of Inspector General issued a warning that seniors are being targeted by companies pushing DNA testing. Reports from the mainland say it could happen at a health fair or a senior community event. And this summer, the scam arrived in the islands. So far, agencies on Oahu and on Kauai have been approached, so officials want everyone to know they should be on guard. Kaipolani Cullen is with the state's Senior Medicare Patrol. She tells us that seniors need to be wary of this latest scheme to steal their Medicare number, you know, because you could get saddled with fees in the thousands of dollars.
So, Catherine, this is really different because we're not talking about 23andMe or DNA.
Ancestry.com.
Ancestry.com, any of those types of companies. What we're talking about is genetic testing that is done through hospital and laboratories that are actually trying to find out a person's genetic predisposition towards certain diseases. So these tests are very, very expensive to run. And unfortunately, particularly in the 48 contiguous states, we have had a run on people who are actually employees of different genetic testing companies who are scamming people in group situations, pitching to them all of the wonderful benefits of DNA testing, which certainly there are, but it is not for everyone. And what they do is they trick kupuna into doing these tests, and then they bill Medicare. And this is a huge problem because only in very rare cases will Medicare actually cover the cost of genetic testing. And of course, it must be done by a person's own physician and referred by that physician. With the types of scams that are going on right now, they have their own in-house physicians. And these people create fake referrals for DNA testing. And they're not really needed. But the kupuna are a scam because, of course, who doesn't want to know if they are predisposed to something like diabetes or Alzheimer's or cancer, particularly. So they agree to have these tests done. And in some of the cases, the scammers actually swab their cheeks on the spot and collect their Medicare numbers so that they can bill Medicare directly, and they send these tests in.
And these are expensive tests. We're not talking less than $99 here.
No, these are extremely expensive tests. We're talking $6,000 to $12,000 a hit. And when Medicare eventually denies the claim, then the Medicare beneficiaries are the ones that get stuck with these costs. And so, you know, these can really hurt people financially. So our goal is to get the word out to as many people as possible and make sure that they know not to fall for these types of scams.
Now, you mentioned that we've been seeing this crop up on the mainland. So what's the snapshot here in Hawaii? What have you heard?
Yeah, so thus far, S&P Hawaii has been contacted by some of our partner agencies that operate different senior clubs and venues. And these are what the scammers are looking for. They're looking for an opportunity to get a group of seniors together so that they can get numerous tests done in one big shot. And that's how they make, you know, a lot of money in one hit. Fortunately, two of these organizations contacted us directly and let us know that this was going on. And so we were able to stop it before it actually happened.
So did this just happen like recently, like in the last month or so?
Yeah. Within the last 2 months, we've heard of these two occasions. On the flip side, I feel very sure that individuals have been victims of this scam. They may not know about it yet, and hopefully now they will, but we want them to contact us if this does happen, if they've been approached by anyone. And these scammers are very, very clever. Some have business cards that look very official, may even have an official Medicare logo on them. And they always say that these tests are free. And that's how they trick kupuna into doing the test.
So they're sophisticated scammers, and they're out now to get the sheer numbers by targeting whole groups.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay, so what's the best thing to do if, let's say, you're just an individual and you've been contacted directly? what's a kapuna to do?
Well, we always say never give out your personal information to someone you don't know or don't trust, and particularly your Medicare number. You would only want to give that to your own personal physician or other medical providers. Secondly, the word free, F-R-E-E, I tell Kapuna that a lot of times this could be the worst, excuse me, four-letter word that you ever hear, because its intention is to trick you into doing something. So whenever you hear that word with regard to providing especially some type of medical service, you want to be very, very cautious and investigate before you move forward on anything. If you have any questions, contact your own physician. And of course, always we ask that people contact us at SMP Hawaii.
And have we seen Medicare fraud on the rise?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Seniors are the number one target because they have the income. They have the availability also because, seniors grew up in a world where trusting somebody that you don't know was normal. And the world that we live in today is completely different, where you distrust initially, and then over time, you learn to grow trust. But for our local kupuna in particular, we've learned that, especially with people in positions of authority, that whatever they ask or whatever they ask of you, you go ahead and you do because they are to be respected. So that's one of the things that we face is people don't like to report for that reason, and also because frequently they're just embarrassed. They got victimized sometimes for a pretty good sum of money. They don't want other people to know, particularly their own family members. But it's really important because we can't assist in the fight against these types of fraud unless it's brought to our attention.
Right. So there's no shame in this. If you've been duped, you want to make sure that it doesn't happen to anybody else. And so if you can come forward and report it and let someone know that this is what's happened.
That's absolutely right.
Okay. Anything else? Any other information that you think is worth underscoring at this point?
Well, this is just the newest flavor of a Medicare scam. In fact, I brought a document with me today that talks about the same scam happening in 2015. Which is some time ago. And these scams tend to just recirculate over and over with a different flavor each time. So back in April, you might recall, or the listeners might recall in the news, there was a report about a big DME or durable medical equipment bust of about $1.9 million. And this was a 24-person crime ring. One of the biggest ones that ever happened. This was another case of Medicare fraud. And in this case, they were selling medical braces, which is another common scam. So the service or the product changes, but the scenario doesn't change that much. So again, we just ask that people, whenever they're offered something that's free, that has to do with their medical services, that they go to a physician, their physician that they trust, that they not just take the word of a stranger.
Right. So if you hear a pitch about DNA, think twice and check it out.
Yes, right. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you, Catherine. Appreciate your having me.
That was Kaipo Cullen, program manager with the state's Senior Medicare Patrol. She's been talking about the latest Medicare scam that tries to use DNA tests to snare new victims. We've probably all experienced power surges from time to time, but now we're learning about power sapping issues related to rail. That's our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Marcel Henry joins us from their studios in Kaimuki. Good morning, Marcel.
Hey, Catherine. How's it?
So this is a really kind of quirky story. Power sapping.
Yeah, so kind of the gist of it is when rail comes online, HECO says it will be able to accommodate with the electrical grid the added load that comes from rail and the power involved in running the line. Where it's still concerned, however, where HECO's still concerned is this issue of voltage swings, particularly when the trains accelerate, when they are leaving the stations. If too many trains are all taking off all at the same time in a given area, it could draw too much power in the sense that it's sucking it away from nearby customers just off the guideway and the like, and it could affect the performance of household appliances or electrical equipment if that swing is too sharp. So this is what both HECO and HART are looking to investigate and test more thoroughly in the months ahead.
I mean, that just sounds wacky. Like, my toast won't pop up and my hair dryer won't work.
Right. So when I was talking to Colton Ching, he's the HECO head who handles these sorts of situations, I was really trying to get to ultimately what could this mean. You know, you hear generally that it would affect service along the lines, and that's really kind of ultimately what it is appliances would have to work harder. They try and draw more current in the physics of electricity, and that could basically just make various electrical components work in odd ways, or even in a worst case scenario, damage it. So that is what HECO and HART need to address before the interim service starts next year. December 2020 is what they are still shooting for a full Aloha Stadium. They might even start a little earlier to Pearl City. But yeah, it's something that they need to investigate. And now that they have trains that are running, that they are doing, you know, tests and running the operations out by Waipahu up on the guideway there, they will have the chance to check kind of the actuals and how these trains are, how much power they actually are running, and kind of extrapolate from there how much of an issue these voltage swings may be, and whether or not the city would then have to purchase special equipment to mitigate the voltage swings, which is out there. But again, that then comes back to budget and, right, you know, how does this impact the cost of rail? And that is still kind of an outstanding issue there. Neither of these parties is really willing at this point to say, well, this is how much these extra components, which are called static compensators or STATCOMs, how much this would cost in a worst case scenario if you had to install them throughout the length of the line. What HART is confident it can do, and how they might avoid adding yet more costs, is to stagger the departure of the train so that they are, in fact, not accelerating all at once, and that you could do that since it's an automated driverless system, you know, that you basically just program it and make sure that trains in a given station aren't all taking off at the same time.
Let's hope that the fix will be simple and not expensive.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, right now I talked to Sam Carnaggio, who's the project director at HART, and he's saying, yeah, I mean, it's a risk, but he's not considering it a major risk, but it still seems kind of like an interesting issue to have to solve to make sure that you're not affecting power customers around the rail line.
Right. And your article mentions that one of the big costs that they're concerned about has to do with the rail parcels in Kaka'ako as they get into this urban core.
Yeah, that's right. They did happen to have a briefing on the major risks just a couple of weeks ago, and that was the top one that they flagged was property acquisition in general. They were careful not to specify Kaka'ako and Howard Hughes, but that does remain a, you know, that's a that by that just from the reports, that these two parties have been $100 million apart at some point, and they could be headed for court next year. So that and, you know, signing this final contract with to launch a public-private partnership and making sure that they have the money and that comes in on budget, those are really the main things that they're focusing on.
Right. I know they did finally get around their those lines that were really close to the guideway. I know that they worked out a deal so that they could bring in those special kind of cherry picker trucks to service
exactly.
those lines.
Exactly. Right. Specialized trucks. And again, they had to go through this with HECO, extensive testing. If it wasn't going to be to HECO's liking, it would have been a lot more than the $70 million that it did actually cost to fix that with the trucks and with some relocation of those
right.
lines.
So at least we've got that problem solved. Now we'll have to look at this one for down the road.
But just keep going.
Yes. Yeah. Thanks so much, Marcel. That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's reality check. And if you've not yet read the story, go to civilbeat.org.
On the next Fresh Air, tracing the course of the opioid epidemic, we speak with Washington Post investigative reporter Scott Higham about newly released federal data tracking the 76 billion opioid-based pain pills shipped to pharmacies over a seven-year period. The records come from a still unresolved lawsuit by states and cities against drug companies. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Unlocking the mysteries of our marine ecosystems. Well, scientists are doing just that, using a DNA technique to discover just what lives in the deep coral reefs of the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. Take a listen to this story from HPR's Casey Harlow.
Researchers with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration returned to Oahu last week after an expedition to the Papahanao Mokua Kea Marine National Monument. Although they found invasive algae outbreaks and a reef destroyed by Hurricane Walaka, there is also good news. They found a new form of coral reef habitat at a depth of 300 feet off the Pearl and Hermes Atoll. To better understand what lives there, the expedition team brought back samples to conduct an interesting test. Richard Pyle is with the Bishop Museum and was the expedition's deep sea tech expert.
We collected water samples for eDNA analysis. Now, eDNA refers to environmental DNA. Everyone's familiar with taking DNA off of a person or off of an organism. But what eDNA is samples all the free DNA floating out in an environment. In our case, that environment was the deep coral reefs. And what it'll tell you is not just what single species has what DNA, but the whole suite of organisms that live on a reef. They're shedding slime and scales and all kinds of their DNA is just permeating the water.
Pyle says this concept has been used for years on shallow coral reefs and on land. But it's not until recently that researchers started turning to it for deep reef environments. He explains how the process works.
You bring up a clean, sterilized tube. It has to be sterilized because you don't want to contaminate it with any of the water from shallow organisms or land or anything. And then what we do is we run it through a vacuum pump and suck all that water, a full liter of water, through a tiny little filter, a very, very fine filter. And that traps all the DNA molecules. So then we take that little piece of paper, that filter, stick it in a vial of preservative, and then analyze it. And they have new modern next generation DNA sequencing where it doesn't just target a specific organism, it looks at all the DNA, and then you can figure out who these organisms are.
Pyle says the eDNA test speeds up the process of knowing what organisms live below the surface.
Historically, the way we find out what species live on a reef is we go dive on them and we look at them and we write them down or we take pictures. But that's the conspicuous stuff that you can see. What you can't see is all the little things hiding in the holes. But all of those things, their DNA gets in the water just like the conspicuous things does. So this technique seems very promising for figuring out who else is on the reef besides what we saw there.
Scientists are in the process of analyzing the water samples taken from deep and shallow coral reefs during the expedition. The results will help researchers better understand reef ecosystems of the northwestern Hawaiian Islands and beyond. From Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Casey Harlow.
Now, Casey's joining us in the studio this morning to talk more about this sleuthing in the sea. I just love this story. It's so interesting.
Oh, no, yeah. I've definitely talked to Richard for a good solid 15 minutes on the docks when the Rainier came in from the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. Obviously, the big news that came out of that was they found beds of this new algae that they don't know where it came from, but they believe it came from a seaweed farm, like an aquaculture farm, and that was just blanketing certain parts of the Pearl and Hermes Atoll. And also, a complete reef was destroyed by a hurricane last year. That was the big news that came out. But when I started talking to other people, there was also some good news that came out of this. They found a new coral, not really a coral habitat, but a reef habitat, 300 feet off the Pearl and Hermes Atoll, with lush beds of sargassum algae, better known as limukala. And so basically they found this new habitat down there, and they also were able to have this new test that they're conducting right now.
That's fascinating, just so fascinating. So that's great. So they had kind of big bad news, but really good news and doing just good basic science out there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, every time they go out there, they always find something new, or they always have some interesting hook that they are coming back with. They're always learning about these sorts of things. And also deep coral reefs, not much is known about them, but every time they go out and then they start researching this, they are learning more and more with each trip. And so this eDNA thing makes that whole process a lot easier.
You know, to think that, you know, gosh, yeah, everybody's going to shed something, right? And then they just kind of follow the clues and figure out, oh, yeah, you know, this fish and you know, that slug or whatever.
Right, right. So instead of, like Richard was alluding to, instead of diving down and saying, oh, I saw this fish or I saw this or that, they basically get water samples, run it through that fine filter, and then they catch everything because water is water. Everything goes out into it. So they'll know if there's like a crab hiding in a hole somewhere. They know that crab is present. They know that the slime of like a certain slug is there because it was present within that water sample.
I wonder though if they think, oh gosh, this is like too much information. You know?
Oh, I guess for them, all information is good information, right? It gives them a better idea of what is down there. And like what Richard was alluding to in the piece, this has been done for years in shallow coral reefs and on land, but this is kind of the first time that they are doing this for the northwestern Hawaiian Islands at a depth of around 300 feet. And for they took multiple samples on this trip as well.
Now, are there any plans to use this eDNA process and technique elsewhere?
He said that it has been conducted in the past in shallow coral reefs. So this is the first time that they're doing it up in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And he also says that within the next maybe 5 years or so, this may be the go-to method. So we may see more eDNA, this method, being used for scientific discoveries.
Yeah, because as they go deeper and deeper with the robotics, they could probably just, you know, find out more about these mysterious creatures.
Right, yeah, exactly. In this case, on this expedition, they had rebreather apparatuses, and they were down there for a good 13 hours a day, just taking notes, collecting samples, and things like that.
And so will this be published in some findings down the road?
Hopefully. He didn't want to give away too much,
okay.
And he's not too sure of what the results are going to be because they just came back and they have all these samples.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. But thanks so much, Casey.
No, thank you, Catherine.
That was HBR's Casey Harlow talking about the new DNA sequencing technology used by scientists. You can find his stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Would you describe yourself as a rebel?
Rebels are not troublemakers. They're people who break rules that should be broken.
How to activate your inner rebel? No leather jacket required. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 7, following Says You.
This morning, we pulled a few pages from Kula's farming history. Now, while the region is perhaps most recognized for its world-famous Maui onions, upcountry farmers also grow everything from lettuce to tomatoes, carrots, cabbages, and potatoes. If you love lavender, there's plenty of that, too. And as with other crops that have waxed and waned over the years, potatoes were once a major source of income for Maui farmers and for the state. Here's a story. During the 19th century, whale oil heated and lighted homes and ran machinery. Now, Pacific whaling ships routinely made port to the islands to resupply. And to accommodate sailors unaccustomed to taro or rice, Kula farmers began growing potatoes, which took well to the rich volcanic soil. Although the whaling industry slowly petered out, the California Gold Rush in 1849 fueled the demand for island produce. Kula farmers supplied miners with tons of potatoes, onions, corn, and other crops, thus earning Kula the nickname New Kaleponi, the Hawaiian pronunciation of New California. There were no winners today, but thanks to Mark Sakamoto, he stumped you on today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, a quake shook the Big Island this morning, just a reminder of the power deep in our Earth's crust. Scientists took notice earlier this summer when a small pond of green water appeared in Kilauea. Our contributing reporter, Sherry Bracken, has been talking to scientists about this latest development. Good morning.
Good morning. Aloha.
So what can you tell us about this? I remember reading that it was described as a small anomaly that they were watching.
Well, it isn't, I suppose it could be called an anomaly because there's not been any water in the bottom of Kilauea crater for at least two centuries. And this one was discovered a few weeks ago. A helicopter pilot was doing LIDAR or laser mapping for Hawaiian Volcano Observatory to map the summit. And he saw a pool or a pond or some murky green color down low. And it turned out that it actually is water. So I talked with Hawaiian Volcano Observatory geophysicist Jim Koehikawa to find out what they really know about it. And the first thing is, as of about 2 weeks ago, the amount of water they're calculating, and wait, I just want to mention, this is 1,500 feet down. The bottom of Halemaumau is very, very far down. So this is not something they can just walk up to and take a look at. This is pretty far down. So using laser measuring devices and infrared cameras, they were able to determine that it's around 227,000 gallons as of a couple weeks ago. And by comparison, a 20 by 40 foot swimming pool generally has around 30,000 gallons of water. So this is like almost 10 times bigger than a swimming pool. The other thing that they determined measuring with an infrared camera is that it's pretty hot. It's around 160 degrees. And that doesn't account for any heat loss between where the water really is and the measuring device. The other thing is the color, as you mentioned, is sort of a milky green. And I asked Jim Koehikawa what that implied and where the water came from. So the first thing is the water could be coming from rainwater. And if it were to do that, you'd expect it to go up and down with rainwater. There hasn't been a lot of rain in Volcano recently, but also the fact that it's that milky green color, they're thinking it's more likely groundwater and that the color is possibly because sulfur has scrubbed into the water. They're not seeing any SO2 emissions of note right now, so he said there's probably a lot of sulfur down there. It could be getting scrubbed into the water. And the other reason they think it's probably groundwater is that it is steadily rising, about a yard a week.
Now, do we have any indication that this has happened before?
Interestingly, it has, but that was around 2,000 years ago.
Okay.
And yeah, so it's not anything they've seen very recently. And they discovered that because scientist emeritus Don Swanson has been doing studies, and he and other colleagues have been working to determine the actual age of the Kilauea caldera. And they do that by looking at the composition of the rocks and that which has been thrown out of the crater. And they now believe that centuries ago, there was rapidly rising magma, there was water, the groundwater, and that created large explosions. So they do believe there was water, but like I said, they haven't seen water for at least two centuries. I mean, there's no physical evidence of it, and there's no written documentation since any written records have been kept.
Now, when I first read the story, when they first noticed this, I think they saw this, you know, strange green color, and so if it was like a small ponding of water, but then that there may have been a couple of others that have popped up. So is it like three small ponds, or is it now like one larger area?
It's one larger because the water was just slowly coming up. And the thing is, they have a test well that's drilled, and it's been there for a while, that's about a half mile away. And that is to take a look at the groundwater. And that right now is at a higher level than the water inside the Kilauea caldera or the Kilauea crater. And so their supposition is that the groundwater, if it is groundwater inside the crater, will continue to rise, and it will reach equilibrium with that test well.
So what happens?
What happens? Well, the thing that doesn't happen is large explosions. In order to have large explosions, such as existed 2,000, 3,000, more thousands of years ago, you have to have two things. One is the water puddle, the water pond. The other thing is you have to have very fast upwellings of magma that could create explosions. But there is no magma ascent now, and Jim Kohikawa said that the history of Kilauea has been relatively moderate magma rise, even during things like the Kilauea Iki fountainings in 1959. So this is not something they are expecting, because normally a normal magma rise and water would just result in steam, and that's what they're anticipating. But they really don't know what's going to happen because this has not happened for such a very long time. I just wanted to say this is different from what happened last summer. Everybody may remember that last summer there were explosions inside the Kilauea crater, and that was created because of gas that had been trapped during the collapses of the caldera. So as the gas wanted to get out, it threw rocks up with it. And even though those went up 20,000 feet, when Jim said he was talking about the large explosions that happened several thousands of years ago, that would have been huge. So, you know, the message is we're not looking yet at anything that's major, but the scientists are continuing to study it, and they need to get a sample to really know more, and they're working to do that.
Yes, I was just going to ask, how do they figure out how hot this water is? You know, how do they get the sample?
Well, the hotness, they were able to figure out pretty much by infrared cameras. So they know it's around 160 degrees. That's pretty hot. And so that's good information to have. You know, it means it's coming up and being heated by magma. But how do they find more? I asked whether a person could somehow rappel down. No, absolutely not. Too far down. The sides are too steep. There's too much rubble. Person might get down, but might not get back.
Mm.
Second options are a drone and a helicopter, and they're going to meet with the national park. They've been talking with drone operators and helicopter operators to see what the options are, because one of the risks is if you put a drone down, it's possibly not going to come back, which would be not a good thing. And with a helicopter, it has to be able to hover above the crater, has to have a very long lead. It has to be weighted in a way that it can get down into the pond and get back up. So they are working on the options, and they're very focused right now on getting samples.
And how is the weather in that area?
Well, it's been good. We are having afternoon rains and like that, but it's just normal weather. We're not having anything different from our normal summer weather patterns. But it hasn't been raining a lot in Volcano, is what Jim told me.
Okay, so that wouldn't really be so much a factor. But yeah, you are thinking of safety for the scientists and the safety of the equipment, depending on whatever they decide to do in order to try and get more information.
Oh, absolutely. And then, of course, the National Park has rules about what they allow inside the park, although I'm sure they are eager to find out what's going on as much as they can also. Also, just so you know, Hawaiian Volcano Observatory has installed a webcam. So you can go on to the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory website. You can go to the webcam and you can watch the water pond.
Oh, that's great. So for those of us who are volcano nerds, we can eat it up.
I know, and it's kind of fun. The whole, you know, the volcano is such a fascinating geological entity, and of course the scientists have tons to learn, and they're eager to learn all they possibly can, and that includes about this water pond.
Yes, I mean, a powerful force. We have to respect what's there, but we obviously do want to learn what's going on in our Earth's crust. It's just fascinating stuff.
Well, it is fascinating, and Jim also said that there's nothing special happening at either Mauna Loa or Kilauea to note. I mean, there's no activity other than the normal background earthquakes, of which we have many all the time, but nothing special is really happening.
Okay, but this is the show, the greatest show.
It is.
All right, thanks so much, Sherry.
Thank you. Take care, Catherine. Aloha.
Aloha. We have been talking with Sherry Bracken, our contributing reporter from the Big Island, about the green water that's been ponding at Kilauea Volcano. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we open the phone lines for a discussion about suicide. Why are the rates among our young people so high? It's a parent's worst nightmare to lose a child in this way. Do you have a personal story that you'd like to share, help others cope? Join us live, call in, or call our talk back line and record your experience. Call 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed this show or want to find a past one, go to our conversation page. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.